Hello and welcome to Out of Touchstone. My name is Mike DeKalb. We've got another special episode for you today. I recently interviewed the very talented writer and director, Ron Shelton. I actually got to meet him at a book signing last year. He was promoting a terrific book he'd written called The Church of Baseball, which details the production of probably his most famous film, Bull Durham. But he also wrote and directed two films for Touchstone Pictures, 1989's Blaze, and the 2000 film Play It to the Bone. We chatted for a little over an hour on Zoom about his upbringing in California, his minor league baseball career, and his eventual transition to Hollywood. Now, I'm a big fan of his work, so it was a real treat to talk to him. I hope you will enjoy it as much as I did. Coming up next after the theme music.
I know I've become a problem for you.
Don't go pushing me about my problems, child.
A woman has got to push. No offense.
All right. Pushing I respect. A man don't share his problems with a woman no how.
Well, I guess I just overestimated the fine governor of the great state of Louisiana. I guess I just thought that going to bed with a man could mean a little more than thrashing around all night in wild ecstasy. Thought it could mean cuddling and toasty warmth, sharing one's innermost needs and fears. That's what getting naked truly means to me. That's what sex truly is. Well, I'm sorry. It is too bad. I guess you don't ever want to get totally naked with me.
Pleased to be joined by the very talented writer-director, Ron Shelton. You know him, of course, from Bull Durham, White Men Can't Jump. How are you doing this morning, Mr. Shelton?
I'm just happy to be here and hope I can help the ball club.
Oh, I was waiting for you to say that. I was so waiting for you to say
that. I have two things I know forever. I know how to open an interview and what to get for wedding presents.
Candlesticks?
Yep.
Tell me I don't know this movie. Okay, I got to start with just two quick things. First one is, in 2011, on my birthday, I went to a screening of Bull Durham at the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica, and you were there to do a Q&A, and it was absolutely enlightening, because this is probably my favorite sports movie, and the stories you were telling, obviously, about your minor league baseball days, and also about your interest in filmmaking. You mentioned how the movie that inspired you to make movies was the same movie that inspired me to go to film school, which was Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. And then last summer, you have a new book out, which is called The Church of Baseball, which I believe was, I thought it was all about the making of Bull Durham. It's so much more than that. And I went to a book signing. You were really gracious enough with your time. I was throwing out questions for you based on stories that you'd mentioned at that Q&A, and you just kept saying, it's in the book, it's in the book. And I read it recently on a flight. I read the halfway on the flight there, and I read the other half on the flight back. It reads like a textbook. I was really, really impressed with all the stuff about screenwriting, because I mean, I went to film school. I did writing classes, and I feel like I learned more in that than some of the textbooks that I had in school.
I thank you that, because the editor of the book editor, Peter Gethers from New York, he was a close friend of William Goldman. And he's, when I wrote this book, he said, this book should be next to Goldman's in every film school about screenwriting. And I've never taught screenwriting, but when I find out what they're teaching, I can't believe that's how they're teaching screenwriting. It's taught like, you know, something that an AI creature would write. In other words, it's all about, you know, where things fit and how they, instead of the emotion, the heart, the storytelling, the narrative, the conflict, the characters. Is anybody teaching that anymore, or just what happens on page 37?
Sure, sure. How is the book tour going, by the way?
Well, the book tour is over, but...
Oh, it's over, okay.
I'm going to Tucson as a national book festival this weekend, and they invited me like 8 months ago, and I said yes because I have an affection for Tucson. I went to the University of Arizona there, and I like the area a lot and the university, and I shot half of Tin Cup there, so it's a bit of a homecoming.
Yeah, I mean, I'm originally from the Midwest, and when I finished film school and moved to Los Angeles, I drove across the country, spent a night in Tucson. I had a buddy who was going to the University of Arizona, so I'm very familiar with that town. Well, you know what's funny is I feel like you're so well known for your terrific sports movies, as I mentioned, Bull Durham, White Men Can't Jump, of course, Tin Cup. I wanted you on this podcast, and when I approached you at the book signing as well, our show is about the history of Touchstone Pictures. It was an idea that one of my friends, we both worked at Fox. And then we went over to Disney. And so we had this idea where we were like, I remember that logo. Everybody knows that blue logo with the lightning bolt. Those were the movies of our childhood. It was movies that I would have either seen or remember seeing trailers for. And you directed two of them. You directed Blaze and Play It to the Bone. And so I figure you probably talked a lot about Bull Durham. And I want to kind of pick your brain on those two movies. But before we get there, I do want to kind of go into a little bit of your beginnings. I know that you said you're born and raised in California. And when I was reading the book, I saw Santa Barbara, I saw Bakersfield, there's Taft is in there. You got the floor. Go specifically, what parts of California were you from? Yeah.
Well, I sort of all over Southern California. I was born in Whittier when it was orange groves and oil wells. My grandfather was from England, and grandmother, they came through Ellis Island. He was a boat builder, so he ended up in San Pedro and then bought a ranch in Whittier. And my father was West Texas to Bakersfield to Taft in the oil fields. And somehow the England and the oil fields of West Texas all met at Bakersfield. But after bouncing around as a small child, my father on the GI Bill went to Santa Barbara State College. A lot of people don't realize long before it was UCSB, it was Santa Barbara State College. And like, anybody growing up in Taft and Bakersfield, I said one time, "When did you leave?" He said, "When did you leave Taft?" He said, "The day I was old enough to drive." And after the war, he'd seen the ocean, and he said, "Oh my God, I'm going to go use the GI Bill and go to Santa Barbara State College." And he did, and we just never left. I mean, who would?
Sure.
So, me and my family and generations have grown up and gone to all the public schools here, Santa Barbara High School, and I went to a small college there. But that's sort of it. And then when I played baseball, I lived all over the country, which the book tells a few stories about. So,
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was curious if like, yeah, when you played baseball in high school, was it a situation where sports was a way to get out of that town? You know, if you were trying to get a college scholarship, or was it more just you got a chance for the minor leagues and then that would be your ticket out of that area?
I figured I was going to college in Santa Barbara. I mean, Santa Barbara was a big high school, big public high school, and played all the top. It was at the top level of high school sports at that time, and got to travel everywhere in Southern California, and then in college did the same thing. So that's why I felt very comfortable. I felt like I grew up not just in Santa Barbara, but in all of, Santa Barbara, Ventura, Los Angeles, and Orange counties was sort of, my home.
Okay. And I remember like one of my favorite stories that you told at that first Q&A that I went to was how your film school education was basically watching movies while you played baseball. Was that how it worked, right? Really?
Yeah, I've never taken a film class. I've never read a film book, even though I've now written one. Well, I mean, later I read Bill Goldman, but no, I just kept going to movies and trying to figure out how they worked. Why did they work? Some work and some don't work. And that led me to want to make them. And especially, and I talk about this a lot in the book, the scene in Little Rock, Arkansas, in the Texas League, I saw the Wild Bunch. And it just spun me around. It was different. I loved Westerns, but this was different than other Westerns. There was more going on, and you had to keep peeling the onion back. And it was just the craftsmanship of it was stunning, and it was moving. And as I later read, Sam Peckinpah said, "It's a movie about a bunch of killers chasing a bunch of killers. When they all die, you really care." And
Yeah.
I thought, wow, that's great storytelling.
Yeah, I feel like I'm not necessarily a Western guy as well. And I went to college to study physical therapy. And
Wow.
while I was in college, someone said, you should take a film class. Our school offers a film class. And they showed us The Wild Bunch in that class. And I had to write a paper on it. And it is a perfect movie. Just it is the way that it's this textbook direction, cinematography, and the score. I had never re wasn't really familiar with William Holden at that point. And I've since gone back and watched. Yeah, he's actually
The greatest.
William Holden is actually he was born in O'Fallon, Illinois, which is about 45 minutes from where I live. And I've always joked that I really need to talk to the Chamber of Commerce in that town to get some kind of a sign put up when you drive in that says birthplace of Oscar winner William Holden. Because I know he moved to California after that. Yeah.
And you think, look at all the Wild Bunch. He's brilliant. Sunset Boulevard. Network. I mean, these are completely different kinds of parts.
Bridge on the River Kwai, right?
Bridge on the River Kwai. I mean, the list goes on. And I'm forgetting some right now. But Andy's a movie star. And where are those guys when we need them?
Yeah, it just that movie just kind of hit me. And I know actors always talk about how they enjoy playing villains, anti-heroes. And yeah, you're watching this movie and you're cheering for outlaws. And yeah. I have seen it multiple times here in Los Angeles with random Q&As with people who've written books about him. I think Sam Peckinpah's secretary was at one of the Q&As. It is kind of an inspiring movie. Well, in that case, I want to ask, how did the baseball career end and the film career begin then?
In 1972, there was the first really big baseball strike. The Baseball Players Union was starting to, feel its oats a little bit. And there was a strike. It was about pensions, but two or three years later, it would lead to the huge break in baseball, the reserve clause, where baseball players said, wait a minute, you don't own me the rest of my career just because you signed me when I was an 18-year-old kid, and I should be able to go to another team after so many years. Which is why, first of all, it's why now salaries are big, that and TV. So anyway, there was a strike, and I was in AAA in Rochester, New York, for the Rochester Red Wings and in the International League. And like a lot of, there was no spring training, and everybody thought the season was going to be canceled.
Mm.
And then the season didn't start. And I was married at the time, my first wife, and we had a small child. And I was 25 years old, and I thought, God, I feel like I'm 80 because I'm not the big league yet. You can imagine feeling old. And so I made a very, very difficult decision to leave baseball and to go back to college, because I could see myself turning into what 15 years later I would invent as Crash Davis.
Sure.
So that was a really traumatic change for me, because I played baseball my whole life since I was a kid, you know, semi-pro, high school, college, pro.
What did you study in college then? What did you major in?
Well, I was an English major in a bachelor's degree, undergraduate, and I went to University of Arizona in the visual arts and got a 2-year MFA degree in painting and sculpture, actually.
Okay. Then where does the transition to Hollywood come about? I got to ask you about Roger Spottiswood at some point, because you seem to be attached to him at the beginning of your career.
He was an enormous help to me. I moved back to L.A. After I got my degree, I was teaching in part-time in a junior college, which is like why I gave that job to Annie Savoy later in the script.
Mm.
I thought I could end up teaching part-time in junior college in the middle of the desert forever. And I came back to L.A. as a visual artist. I had a couple of one-man shows and group shows, and was writing screenplays and painting houses in the daytime and doing blue-collar work for about 10 years. And trying to figure out the screenplay thing. And I sold, for $10,000, I sold a screenplay, basically. 12-5, the whole screenplay was sold. Still hasn't been made. but it allowed me to quit painting houses and start getting writing work, which led to getting a couple movies made, which led me to direct. So it was a step. Each step seemed natural. Once I quit baseball, everything else was a natural evolution from one thing to the next.
Yeah, and I feel bad. I've not seen Under Fire yet, and I did see. I was curious because I think, according to IMDb, you did some uncredited rewrites for a film called The Pursuit of D.B. Cooper. I watched that trailer. That looks really entertaining. I don't know why I've never seen that one either. But again, yeah. So then, what was that first step into the industry as far as, like I said, how does Roger Spottiswood come about? It seems like you worked with him.
Yeah, I had, when you're, he was trying to, he was a legendary editor for Sam Peckinpah. He did three he edited or co-edited three Peck and Paul movies, and Sam is a very difficult guy, and to survive three of them is amazing. And Roger was, he was a first assistant on Lion and Winter in England when he was like 19, and I mean, so he was a prodigy editor and making his move into directing. And so when you're doing that, you're always looking for new scripts, new writers that you can afford.
Okay.
Well, I tell writers today, everybody wants what you do. Just do it better and you'll get work, because everybody wants a cheap script.
Sure.
And Roger came across, I don't know, a script of mine that I was trying to get made, still am. And he was hired. I mean, this is really in the weed stuff, but a company, it was Joel Silver and Peter Guber had a new company, and they had three movies they'd shot. One was called Pursuit, one was called Missing, and one was called, they all had titles like that.
Okay.
And Missing was a great and serious political thriller set in Chile by a great director who I can't remember. Anyway, they had this movie about Pursuit of Davy Cooper, and it was, they'd fired like three directors and they had all this footage and it didn't make sense because they kept firing guys. And some of them should have never been fired. It was just bad producing, not bad directing.
Okay.
But there was sort of a partially edited movie that couldn't be released. It had holes in it.
Oh, geez.
And they asked Roger, could he fix it if they gave him 2 weeks to shoot new footage to patch it together? And so he said, yes, if you hire Ron Shelton to write. So I remember I got $30,000 and I wrote, and Roger and I watched this thing over and over and said, well, what if when they walk through that door, instead of coming to that room, there's a whole new thing that happens. And I mean, it was wild. And so I wrote this stuff that made it, if we shot it, made it releasable. And then somebody told us, well, by the way, Treat Williams and Robert Duvall hate each other. And they got in a big fight. And that was another, well, now you tell us. But we went down to Tucson and shot for 2 weeks and patched it all together, and it made it releasable. So I guess it saved some money for them. But that was how that happened, and that led to other movies getting made.
And Under Fire, basically, that's your first published screenplay.
Yeah, and it was a page one rewrite off an existing screenplay, but it was 95% brand new material. It's a movie I encourage you to watch. It's really good. I just watched it again the first time in 25 years and showed my family. Roger did a brilliant job, too. It's quite a good movie. It's set against, you know, the overthrow of Somoza in Nicaragua, and which has now led to a new Somoza called Daniel Ortega. But it's about the press's involvement in that. And I'm very proud of that movie. Very good. Yeah. Pauline Kael said that and Right Stuff with the two great movies of 83. And even though we didn't do any business, we were big in Europe. It was kind of a European kind of movie.
Well, one of the movies I did watch leading up to this was The Best of Times, because I remember that movie as a child and just for whatever reason did not get around to seeing it. I'm a big fan of the Peyton Manning has a show on ESPN Plus called Peyton's Places, and he had Kurt Russell on to talk about Best of Times. I saw that recently, and that kind of also stirred my interest in the film, and I loved it, by the way. It that's the first movie I really feel like you see that, what I call that Ron Shelton formula, where you see these sort of flawed men, you know, a little bit stubborn, their heart's in the right place, but they rely on these strong and wise women to set them straight. And the whole time I'm watching the movie, I'm just like, I see a lot of Bull Durham. I see a lot of White Men Can't Jump in this movie. Was that pretty easy to just draw on your experience of being in Central or Southern California, more or less, for that movie?
It came about from two things. One's my father, who was in Taft growing up. And Taft's 37 miles from Bakersfield. It's where the low end of the oil workers were. It's really a tough town. You know, they tried to lynch a JC, a black junior college student, in the 70s.
Oh, geez.
For being seen with a white girl. I mean, it's hardcore there. But my dad always talked about when we grew up, their big trip of the year would be to Bakersfield. Bakersfield was like Paris to them. And they'd go there at Christmas to see the windows dressed up, you know. And I thought, wow, if Bakersfield is Paris. And Bakersfield also was the big high school team that beat you 78 to nothing every year.
Okay.
They had Frank Gifford, remember?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And anyway, So the idea that the little school and the big city would have this big game. And then in Santa Barbara, I got a call years after I was lived there that the two big high schools, Santa Barbara and the rival high school, San Marcos, had staged a football game among alumni to settle some score 20 years ago, that some disputed victory by whatever. And like 15,000 people came, which is more than any ever came to an actual high school game. In other words, the town packed it out.
Sure.
And these 40-year-old guys were getting in shape to play. And I thought, wow, because I don't romanticize my high school years. A lot of people do. And I thought, well, that's interesting. This is about men who can't leave their childhood and settling scores and all of that. And that's where the movie came from.
Oh, yeah, it's terrific. I just had an interesting little footnote from a Touchstone perspective. The Best of Times was released on the exact same day as Down and Out in Beverly Hills.
And we got killed.
I was going to say, yeah, I had to bring that up, but, you know, because I know that was the movie that kind of helped put Touchstone over the top and was really successful for them, yeah.
Well, you know, we thought we had a good movie, and we did. You know, Quentin Tarantino always talks about Best of Times. It's one of his favorite. He wrote me a letter about it when he was still a clerk in the video store. Nobody knew who he was. I have this letter from this guy about how great this movie is. We our producer, I forget his name, got in a big dispute with Universal, and we became they punished us. I mean, we got buried. Hmm. And who was the number two to Wasserman? He was Spielberg's guy. Anyway, you would remember. He just died, so I can remember. I can mention his name. They didn't like us. They didn't like a producer. They had no, I mean, it was brutal because it was not the only time, but the first time I'd experienced how you could get thrown under the bus. It was not much of a campaign. It was just, they didn't care. And Down and Out was a wonderful movie anyway. So we thought, God, we wish we'd been handled the way that one was handled.
Yeah, I see that a lot. Again, we're going through all these Touchstone movies, and I see a lot of movies where you're like, what happened? Why was this not marketed well? And so I totally get that. Another interesting little Touchstone footnote, you know, you did three movies in a row that you worked with Roger Spottiswood on. The next two theatrical releases he did were both for Touchstone. He did
Turner and Hooch.
Turner and Hooch, and he did Shoot to Kill with Sidney Poitier. Those were both for Touchstone, yeah.
I mean, when I did Blaze for Touchstone, you know, that was Katzenberg. Mm-hmm. Jeff Katzenberg, and people had said, oh, he's difficult, he's this and that. I thought Jeff was great to work for.
Really? I feel like he's one of those people that I've heard stories as well. I've always said I'd love to meet him. Obviously, I'm doing a show about all these movies that he helped greenlight, but
he was smart. He cut to the chase. He didn't give you stupid notes the way everybody does now. I mean, he knew he could articulate. You go to a screening, and, you know, the movie takes time to find itself. You know this. And so you need a studio exec who doesn't panic at the first test score. And you'd go out in the lobby and he'd have like five notes on a little buck slip. And they'd all be ones you go, well, you're great. You know, tighten the opening, tighten the middle, tighten the ending, clarify point A and B. Like, that's it. Now you get pages of notes from junior executives who are still in film school that make no sense, that are trying to show you how smart they are. Jeffrey got to the chase. I like Jeffrey a lot to work with.
Yeah, I mean, especially when reading your book and hearing about your dealings with the executives at Orion for Bull Durham, oh, I can only imagine. I guess we'll transition into Blaze, but I did want to say real quick with the success of Bull Durham, again, I highly recommend the book. I could talk to you about Bull Durham forever, and I know you had told all the stories as well, but I know that you know you got a Writers Guild Award for Bull Durham, you got an Oscar nomination. I was curious, how did the awards change your career? Was it that obvious? Because now you're all of a sudden, what kind of momentum did you have going into Blaze?
Yeah, we won I got New York critics, national critics, LA critics, we got everything but the actual Oscar, ironically. All that helps, of course. What really helps is that you're selling tickets to Bull Durham. Mm-hmm. Katzenberg had turned down Bull Durham.
Really?
Yeah, and I think that's in the book. So suddenly Blaze, which had already been written before Bull Durham, then nobody was interested in it. Now everybody wanted Blaze.
How did you come across Blaze Starr's memoir?
In a 99-cent rack, somebody gave it to me. You know, it was just a kind of a, you know, it's not brilliantly written, and it's kind of a pop, you know, a lot of white space on the page thing, but it's all these chapters of her life told with this sort of girlish innocence, and it's quite a life. And I thought, I'd also read A.J. Liebling's great book called The Earl of Louisiana. A.J. Liebling, one of America's great writers and journalists, was sent down to Louisiana in 1959 by the New Yorker because the governor had just been put in a mental asylum. And it was discovered that that didn't mean he wasn't the governor. Nobody had ever thought to say, you're now disqualified. No, you're now the governor from an insane asylum. And they expected him to write these caustic, acidic, satiric attacks on Earl Long and the whole political system down there. And he basically fell in love with Earl Long. And he started sending these empathetic, knowing essays back to the New Yorker. And the first one starts with something that's like, Southern politics, like sweet corn, loses its sweetness the farther you get from the source, or something like that. In other words, you got to be here in Baton Rouge to really understand what's going on. And in all his essays, he only one time mentions there was an exotic dancer somewhere off in the, you know. And I took both ideas, her view of this scandal as a girl's romance and Liebling's view of Southern politics, and put them together to make the movie, to write the script.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the story plays out well, like a good feature, right? Yeah, I mean, did you purchase the film rights yourself for that book?
Yeah, I think we optioned both. I did. I optioned both of them.
Yeah, and I read in the Church of Baseball book how you, like, you hear the characters while you're writing about them, and this was your first time, I assume, writing about real people. How different was that?
Real people's worse, harder to write about because there's only so you can. Take a lot of dramatic license, but you can't take too much. You know, if it's a D-Day story, the landing still happens at Normandy, not in Puerto Rico. I mean, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And there's certain time, I've got two scripts now that are based on real people. And so you have to be very careful. You have to invent, but you can't invent everything. I don't know. It's a fine line.
Yeah. So then how did Disney get involved at that point?
With Blaze?
Yeah.
I think they made the best offer because everybody suddenly wanted Blaze, the script they didn't get before. And I wanted to do it at Orion, who had been the only company to step up on Bull Durham, but they weren't as well funded as Disney. And I thought the amount of money that they could put up wasn't enough once you got a movie star, because we needed a movie star. I don't remember the numbers, but so I went with Jeffrey and Disney. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And in the book, you also mentioned how you like casting because you get to meet people. And was that the case with Blaze? I mean, I saw that the casting director on that was Victoria Thomas, who also did Play It to the Bone. She did actually one of the films we just talked about on our podcast recently, which is Ed Wood. Is that, I mean, I know there was a lot of people that came through for Blaze. Did you enjoy meeting all these people?
I always enjoy the process. And as I also say in my book, when I next direct, which I hope is this year, I don't want to do self-tapes. I want actors to come in the room. I want to meet actors and actresses. I don't believe that the self-tape has served us well. And so I do enjoy that. It was getting frustrated on Blaze because we couldn't find the actress. You know, we had Paul Newman, but we couldn't find... And every big star came in, and the problem wasn't that they weren't talented or good or looked the part. It was a very tricky part to cast because Blaze Starr was a stripper in the 50s, but stripping in the 50s was a kind of a burlesque act. It was, you know, it wasn't what stripping is today. It was a show. And she owned her own nightclub, The Block, and she on The Block in Baltimore, and she refused to be extorted by the mob. That famous Diane Arbus photograph of her you know, those are knife wounds on her that where the mob was cutting her up.
Oh, geez.
And so she was like the first totally independent, this is pre-women's movement, you know, empowered, own your own business. But she was a sex symbol. I mean, so she was these, and she also was a romantic, and she fall in love every Friday night and have her heart broken every Monday morning. I mean, that was Blaze. So it was hard for a woman in that time in the 80s who, you know, to be an actress is tough, and it's a nasty male world. And so I get it. I, you know, but the women would come in kind of steeled up and tough with masks on, and Blaze was just like open. And it was hard to get an actress who could not play an 80s woman. I needed a 50s person. And after Paul Newman, they said, well, find an unknown. So we found an unknown.
Yeah, because one of my favorite things about talking to people in this regard is your chance to kind of clear the air. I on our podcast, we refer to the trivia section on IMDb, but a lot of times I don't necessarily just throw those out because I like to get those confirmed and double check my sources on those. So I'm gonna ask you now. There was a few things. Number one was I heard that was there 600 actresses that were vying for this part?
No, I don't know how many, but I think we saw 90.
90. Okay. And then I saw that I saw Michelle Pfeiffer was considered. I saw Sean Young was considered. Was there any truth to that?
I don't think Michelle Pfeiffer was considered. I mean, she wasn't, I mean, she's great, but she was very different kind of body type and a kind of an elegant. I don't believe Michelle Pfeiffer is from West Virginia.
Okay.
Even though she's great and I'd love to work with her. Sean Young came in because she was coming off of Don't Look Now or whatever the Costner movie was.
No Way Out. Yeah.
No Way Out. No Way Out. And yeah, no, you know, Kim Basinger, who Demi Moore, I mean, all of the women of the day, and then a lot of unknowns. And then we're interviewing real strippers. That didn't go anywhere. Vicki Thomas saw a lot more than I did.
Okay.
So she might have seen 600, but I think she let 90 have a meeting with me.
And then I guess the obvious question is how did Lolita come about? Because I know that she was in a Touchstone film previously to this. She had a very small part in Adventures in Babysitting. So I don't know if Disney remembered her or not, but how did we get to casting Lolita Davidovich?
Well, this was Vicki Thomas. She had a casting office set up in Toronto. And Lolita was in Toronto and Chicago back and forth. And she was starting to work with the Steppenwolf people. And she was doing little stuff. She did a couple of things for Canadian Broadcasting. I mean, big parts. And Vicki kept saying, look at this girl on tape. Look at her, look at her, look at her. And finally, I was in New York casting in desperation. And Vicki said, let's fly her in from Chicago. So she flew in, and she was very different than the others. You know, it's kind of that you'd say, try this, try that. Okay, okay. I mean, she was very Blaze-like in that regard. She wasn't like, why? Why do you say that? Why is this a male power trip? No, it's okay. Yeah, I'm an actress. Let's try it. Let's stand on our head and do it, you know? So we thought, well, that's interesting. And Paul was in New York. And so we brought Paul in to meet with her and three or four others, including a couple of big stars. And Paul was completely taken with her. After the afternoon of this, he said, what was that? Who is that? She's a force of nature. So Disney said, great, let's meet her. So they flew her out to LA and she did a big screen test and, you know, old time Hollywood screen test where hair and makeup and wardrobe and DP department, everything. And she just knocked everybody out because she was sweet, but she could be sexy and she could be innocent. You could believe this. And she's great with language. She speaks more than one language. So accents are great. And she got it. And Paul fell in love with her. And then I fell in love with her.
Well, yeah, that's another story. Yeah. But I think that the true talent of Lolita Davidovich is the fact that, like you said, from Canada, but yet very believable as being from West Virginia.
It's a working class thing. Also, old world background, you know, parents from Yugoslavia. So there's some working class thing that's just international.
And then, I've seen interviews with you. I saw it in the book as well about your love of The Hustler. So what was that like working with Paul Newman? I thought I saw that he had turned it down. Gene Hackman came in and then Paul Newman came back. Can you clear that up and also talk about the great Paul Newman?
It's true. Paul was in and then he was out and then he was back in again. And when he was out, I said, well, let's go get Hackman. And they were saying, well, Jeffrey was saying Paul's a bigger star, but Gene's a great actor. And I said, well, I know. So we'll just make it cheaper. And then Paul's back. And then, I mean, what I discovered was that, you know, Paul was, as everybody will tell you, the most insecure superstar ever. He was also great to work with, generous, but did not believe in his own work, didn't have any confidence. This is Paul Newman, folks.
Yeah.
And he didn't like to shoot. He just liked to rehearse. And I said, the studio is not paying you and me to rehearse. They're paying us to shoot. But, his book just came out, and which is a memoir that he was working on. And it's all about his insecurity, the book. He never thought he was a very good actor. He thought he was getting by on his blue eyes and good looks. And he was a fabulous actor, And so that's what it was like to work with Paul. And every director I've ever told you say the same thing.
Yeah. And no disrespect to Gene Hackman. I mean, I know he was in Under Fire as well. Paul Newman is Earl Long. Like I really think he kind of nailed that part.
Yeah. So we were dealing with all of that, and that a lot of that, as you know, from my book, is kind of par for the course.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And then I would be remiss if I did not bring up my co-host loves Gaylord Sartain. He did a handful of movies with Ernest for Touchstone, and then he pops up in this movie and we're like, oh, what a pleasant surprise. Please give me a good Gaylord Sartain story. What is
Is Gaylord still with us?
I believe he's still with us, yes.
Well, I love Gaylord. And Gaylord, Vicki Thomas found Gaylord, and he'd been in Mississippi Burning, and I thought, this is the real deal, and he has Cajun, I think, roots and all this stuff, and the greatest accent in the world. But Gaylord can't remember his lines. That's the honest truth. He wouldn't argue it. He cannot remember his lines. So you write them down, and and I remember finally saying, Gaylord, you want a drink? Because he loved his beer. And I said, I poured a scotch right behind the camera. I said, get this line right, and you can have this drink. And everybody looked at me like, Ron, you're going to be arrested for, you can't bribe an actor with a cocktail. I said, well, I am going to do it. And he nailed it. Boom, 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 boom. I said, there's your drink. It was a little drink, but I thought, well, whatever works. I mean, he is the real deal. I loved him, sweet, generous. But sometimes it took a few takes.
Oh, I bet. Well, there's plenty of talent in front of the camera. There's also plenty of talent behind the camera. I wanted to ask you about working with the incredible Haskell Wexler, because he gets an Oscar nomination for Blaze. I mean, I had the great pleasure of meeting him at a screening at the Arrow as well. I used to go there all the time. So what did you learn by working with Haskell Wexler on that film?
Yeah, Haskell, I worked with two Oscar winners, him and then later Russell Boyd. I did three movies with the great Aussie Russell Boyd. Haskell, first of all, it looked beautiful. He won the American Cinematography Award for Blaze, and he got the Oscar nomination. So he did, it was going to look great. That's what you knew about Haskell.
Sure.
You could only push him so fast. That's what also you learned about Haskell, because I always wanted to go faster. Later, when he got his AFI Lifetime Achievement Award, he and I fought a lot, by the way. He asked me to present it, and I made a speech in front of the AFI with Haskell sitting there that sometimes you should trust the creative battles and not be discouraged by them. I said, Haskell and I argued every day and the movie came out great. So don't just surround yourself with yes people, folks. I think good directors and good DPs rise to the challenge of, you know, conflicting points of view sometimes. And he was very happy for that. And then later he came to some things I did, and I always would introduce him. And so, yeah, that was an iconic giant figure. You know, brilliant, brilliant cameraman. So there are other stories out there for a cocktail lounge somewhere.
Well, I do want to mention that the movie does have a great feel to it. It really makes you feel like you're in the Deep South. And before we did this interview, I was talking, my boss is actually from New Orleans. And I told her, I'm actually going to, you know, interview Ron Shelton. And she was like, oh, him and Lolita do a lot of stuff with the city. And I was just curious, do you still have, what is your relationship like with the city of New Orleans now?
Well, we had a house there, second home, for 30 years. I sold it a couple of years ago, but I put everything in storage because I have two or three shows set there that if one of them goes, then I'm going to get a condo there, a little turnkey condo, so I can have a foot there, because I love the city and have a lot of contacts there.
Okay, yeah. Well, in order to wrap up Blaze, I do want to mention that it had a December release. Was it something that Katzenberg and Disney, you thought, was there a chance for awards consideration, or was there a particular strategy for releasing at the end of the year like that?
Yeah, they thought it was an awards movie. They really did. And we didn't get anything other than cinematography. I mean, I thought the script was as good as I'd written. I don't know why it didn't catch fire exactly. It wasn't for lack of support by the studio. I thought Touchstone believed in it. And, you know, sometimes, as you know, you get a bad weekend and you never get your footing, you know.
Oh, sure.
Something just blows everything off the map, and you never, you know, you never really get your traction. And we never did. So that was that.
Yeah. And well, it'd be 10 more years before you came back to Touchstone. So I do want to kind of gloss over a little bit of the 1990s for you. I mean, this was a good time. Obviously, White Men Can't Jump and Cobb and Tin Cup. I forgot that you also wrote the screenplays for Blue Chips and The Great White Hype. I was going to ask, so what did you do after Blaze? Like, how quickly did you transition to White Man Can't Jump? Was there any lost momentum from that?
Well, I decided to do something that, like Bull Durham, was out of my own life, and that I had a unique perspective on, like the minor leagues. And I wanted it to be the opposite of Blaze, in the sense that Blaze is elegantly photographed and almost proscenium-like. And I wanted to get in the dirt and in the streets, and I wanted the camera to move every frame. And I wanted to just load up the Steadicam and let's shoot the whole thing and keep moving. And I wanted it to be fast-paced, and, you know, you don't have to know anything about Southern politics, just... So it's quite a different kind of movie. It's immediate, it's contemporary. But again, it's about racial issues, which are crop up in a lot of my movies. And that's how it came about. So I wrote it very, very, very quickly. And White Man Can't Jump, and that created a relationship with Joe Roth, which later brings me back to Touchstone.
Okay. Yeah. And I was just going to ask you, if you could summarize, how would you say that the film industry changed in the 1990s? I know that there was probably a lot more movies being produced. We had to fill cable syndication spots, the rise of the VHS, and then ultimately the DVD. So before we come back to Touchstone in the late 90s, what did the 90s look like for you? What did you see across the film landscape?
I wish the 90s would come back. I mean, you had people running studios who knew and liked movies, as opposed to now, which is all corporate. You know, corporate, everything is corporate. And I mean, Joe Roth loves movies. Everybody, you know, Ned Tannen loved movies. I mean, Pickup Studio Head, they like movies. Mike Medavoy likes movies, these guys. And And they rolled the dice. Everything wasn't driven by algorithms and by sabermetrics and by analytics. It was, I like this. How much? Can you make it a little cheaper? Go make it. That was the world we still lived in the 90s.
Yeah.
Whereas if a studio liked you as a director and a writer, and they say, if you can get one of those four guys and make it for X, we'll make it. I said, will you make offers to one of those four guys? Yes. Put them in order, 1, 2, 3, 4. And if we don't get any of them, then... And that would be done without a lawyer. That would be done over a drink.
Oh, yeah.
A handshake. And so already the next day, that studio head is calling an agent or likely an actor he's worked with or an actress and say, I got this great Ron Shelton project. I want to send it to you. Can you read it this weekend? We'll meet your price. And, I mean, things moved quickly. And that's how movies got made. And then, the studio, or Joe would say, well, if you can, okay, we can get him, but you're going to have to figure out how to make it a little cheaper because I can't get him. Okay, we can work it out. Let's go do it. Now it's just trying to get people on the phone.
Well, and I one of the notes I had when I was reading the book was that you mentioned movies as being, what do you say, lost leaders for theme parks. Yeah. And I couldn't, obviously, maybe that makes me think of Disney, you know, as well. So then how was Disney different between 1989 and then 1999? I know that we joke about, you know, studios having layers and layers of bureaucracy and oversight. And was that the case with Disney? I mean, Katzenberg was gone by that time when you came back.
It was. I had a good experience on both occasions because you had a powerful, charismatic leader as different as Joe and Jeff are. I pick up the phone, I call Jeff. I pick up the phone, I call Joe. And it was a one-on-one relationship. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's the way it used to be. Now there's just the layers. I didn't even know who I'm talking to. I mean, who? I thought that was the head of it. No. How many people between Dana Walden and Robert Iger and Charlie Andrews and Johnny Davis and, oh, there's seven other, stop it. I can't, what's going on? Stop. That's Disney. And you can't work like that. You can't.
You never dealt with Michael Eisner then? It was just basically Jeffrey and Joe, right?
Jeffrey originally, and then Joe on the reboot. And that was it. I met Michael Eisner once in my life.
Oh, that's funny. Okay. Well, for Play It to the Bone. Okay, we'll talk about that. I was going to ask, how did that story come about? Was that inspired by any kind of a real life anecdote in your life?
Yeah, it was. I was, I'm a big boxing fan. I used to go to all the fights in Vegas and at the Olympic and anywhere there were boxing match. I mean, and Lolita, who by this time I'm with, and she's become a huge boxing fan. We go to Atlantic City to the fights. We go to Reno to the, I mean, crazy. Vegas, New York. People, old timers, not old, I mean, old time boxing people would say, they knew that I liked the undercards. The undercards are the preliminary fights. And on television, the main event would be televised and sometimes maybe two of the preliminary fights. But there's like seven other ones that don't get to TV that start at 4 p.m. when the arena's empty.
Mm-hmm.
And I always would go at 4 and there'd be nobody there. And you watch, and these stories would unfold before your very eyes where one guy would come in with this fancy entourage and fancy outfit and nobody, and the other guy would come in with a towel around his head, some poor kid from Mexico, and where two guys were in his corner that he'd never met. And so one guy was just an opponent, and the other guy was somebody had backed.
Okay.
And sometimes the kid from Mexico with a towel on his neck could knock the other guy out in the first round, and that whole thing would disappear and all the money, you know. So you'd see these dramas. And everybody told me about this fight. They said, you love the undercard. The greatest undercard ever was these two Mexican fighters out of L.A., whose names I can't recall. And they were best friends, and they were like just average fighters, but pros. You know, they were like 10-10 records. And they're working out in the local gym. And they get a call from Vegas saying the undercard for the title fight fell through tonight. We're going to give you plane tickets, fly over here to fight each other. And in my version, they were afraid to fly, so they drove together. just because I had to tell the story. And those two guys put on the most brutal fight anybody ever seen. They went to the, everybody talked about this fight. It was unbelievable. And by this time, the crowd starts showing up, cheering for these two guys. They don't know who they are.
Sure.
And basically they go to the casino and blow their money and they drive back to LA. That's the story. That happened. And at the premiere at the El Capitan of that, I found one of the two guys in that fight was still alive. We found him and brought him back and introduced him.
Really?
Yeah. Well, and then we gave $50,000 to the an organization called the Retired Boxing Association, which was a private fund to try to get indigent fighters off the streets, because you know professional boxers have no health care fund. Mm-hmm. of all businesses to not have any health care. So we tried to send them some money.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I don't think there's probably no union, is there? Right? Yeah.
No union.
not like in other sports. Well, you mentioned it about how in the true story that they had flown and you decided to make it a road trip. Was that difficult? Were you nervous about the constraints of using a road trip as the focus of the story?
No, because I always liked that drive to Vegas and I knew all the stops.
You like it?
Yeah. Well, if you don't hit it Friday afternoon or Sunday afternoon, on a Tuesday morning, it's fine. Baker, I shot a scene in Baker and the Mad Creek. I don't mind it. It's easier than the flight. I mean, it's a 4.5 hour drive, 4 hour drive. By the time you go to the airports at both ends and fly, it's 4 hours. So, yeah. My car.
Well, from a casting standpoint, I mean, you got Woody Harrelson back. Did you make a conscious effort to distance the Vince character and play it to the bone from Billy Hoyle in White Man Can't Jump?
Yeah. Woody's Woody. He's going to bring Woody to anything. But I don't think, you know, Billy's a slacker. I mean, in White Men, I mean, he's the guy without, it's irresponsible. He's the guy who won't grow up. Wesley's trying to grow up. He's got family. Mm-hmm. And Rosie's way ahead of Billy in her advancement, and she skates off and leaves him, and he's still playing basketball. I think Vince has more of a future than Billy.
And then was Lolita always going to play Grace in this film?
I wrote the script quietly and quickly, and I don't even think she knew I was writing it. And then when I got Woody, I said, here's your part. Let's go make it. And that's how it happened.
Just that simple. Okay. Well, I need you to help me clarify the release strategy, because I feel like if you go on IMDb, it says Play to the Bone 1999. I think of this as a 2000 film because the premiere was in January. The film goes wide in mid-January. But I did see that it was released, I think, is it just in Los Angeles on Christmas Day?
Yeah, I've had three unsuccessful Christmas launches. Cobb was also released on Christmas Day. Not exactly a... let's take a break from Christmas shopping and go watch this horrible human being. They believed in it. The director rarely has anything to do with release strategy of a movie, however much he argues. And it doesn't mean we're always right. I mean, the studio was right about Bull Durham and White Man Can't Jump. And they both came out against big, big movies in June. Mm-hmm. And we're both very successful, and I thought we're going to get killed by the big movies, and we were counter-programming, a term I didn't even know, and it worked. So marketing guys, unless they've been given instructions to throw the movie under the bus, you know, marketing people want it to be successful because they get rewarded on successful movies. So they're not trying to hurt you. It just strategically, I thought the campaign was wrong. They sold it as a boxing comedy. It was not a comedy. It was a love story. So I didn't agree with the sales approach, I must say, on Play It to the Bone.
Yeah. And what I find kind of interesting is that on this show, we watch the movies in chronological order, and we kind of, at the end of the year, we'll do like a year in review. I'm going to put this in the 2000, just because I think of this as being more of a 2000 film. But it's interesting that I have you on now, because we're wrapping up 1994 on my show, and that is halfway between Blaze and Play to the Bone. It's almost perfectly halfway between the two of them. Well, you know, in your opinion, I noticed as the 2000s roll around, you're not doing sports movies. Is it, how do you think the landscape has changed? I feel like there's fewer sports movies in this century.
It's these damn algorithms.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
It is, because they say there's no foreign. There was no foreign on Bull Durham. I still get checks on that movie. I mean, stop it. I've got sports movies I'm trying to make. Not easy to cast always, but because you need an athletic person who means something of a certain age. But no, I think, you know, if you hear me lambaste the algorithms driving the business, the problem with algorithms is they're based on everything, data that's already been gathered. An algorithm can't picture something that there's not a model for, right?
Yeah, yeah.
An algorithm, Star Wars would never get made today if there were algorithms, because nobody'd ever done that.
Sure.
Well, Durham still wouldn't get made today. No foreign. Who cares? There's no big game. Nobody gets a home run. What are you? Nobody's on the team. What happened to the team? There's no big game. I mean,
yeah.
Where are you? So this is why all the movies all look the same.
Yeah.
they do. They're being made by some AI bot somewhere. And so I think that's one of the problems with getting sports movies made. You know, they don't fit the computer model.
Yeah. When I used to work at 20th Century Fox, and we had a presentation with somebody who was one of those number crunchers, basically, who had looked over spreadsheets, and they had to ask him, why did you choose this movie? Or was there a movie that you wish you would have gotten and the numbers said it wasn't going to be popular, and so you didn't take it? And got a lot of fascinating stories about what could have been, what some great movies Fox could have made, but somebody told them otherwise.
Well, you know, Joe Roth, what launched him was, you know, he helped put together Morgan Creek with James Robinson. And, you know, he was kind of an indie guy. And when he got the job at Fox, he brought a movie in turnaround called Home Alone from Warner Brothers. And I know all the stories of that because I was dealing with Joe a lot at the time, and I had friends at Warner Brothers. Now, this was John Hughes' movie. This guy was about as golden as you could get, right? And and the budget, Warner's had said, we won't make it for a nickel over $15 million. And the budget kept coming back $16 million. Now, the head of Warner Brothers Physical Production, Bill Young, was a great guy. He knew his stuff. And he would say, this is what it costs. You can say what you want, but this is what it'll cost. They said, we're not going to make it. So Joe said, I'll take it. So he takes it over. And how many $1 billion is that franchise worth now?
Oh, yeah.
Why? Because of $1 million dispute by somebody somewhere. That $1 million cost billions of dollars to Warner Brothers. Not run by the phone company, by the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, what's funny is, you know, there is one group that is still making really good sports movies, and that's ESPN. And I feel like those 30 for 30 documentaries have all been pretty fantastic. And you had the pleasure of directing the one called Jordan Rides the Bus. How did that come along?
That was, yeah, in the first year of 30-30, nobody knew if this was going to work or not. And they approached me and a bunch of directors who had some resume. We had resumes, and yeah, I'll do it. How much money do I get? Nothing. You get nothing, but you'll do whatever you want. And I said, well, you got to pay my assistant. Because, you know, and I tied in with Steve Michaels, who had a company, Asylum Pictures, and they made a lot of documentaries. So I had a, you know, he had editing, he had all that set up. I had a system in place because we couldn't figure out an idea I wanted to do something in Cuba because I wanted a free trip to Cuba, and nobody wanted that. And then we did that 15 years after Jordan, in fact, had left basketball for baseball. So, and I said, Jordan, am I making this up? Didn't Michael Jordan leave for a year to play baseball? I was like, yeah, that really happened. I mean, you couldn't get your head around it.
Oh, yeah.
Think about that. Think about it. He won three championships. He leaves. He plays minor league baseball. He comes back and wins three more. And I said, well, the prevailing wisdom is that he did it because of gambling and he had to get out of the league. I suspect that's not true, but let's. And I had the title, Jordan Rides the Bus, right away. And because the rumors were that he bought the bus for the team, which turns out to be not true, all of which we go through. And along the way of making that, which was a great experience, I discovered that, you know, they were begging him not to leave. And it was all about his dad being murdered on the side of the road. His dad wanted him to play baseball. And he was actually known as a high school baseball player, not a basketball player.
Sure.
The very end. And it became kind of had a new complexity. And Jordan said, go for it. I never interviewed him. We took all existent interviews and wove them through so that it seemed as if we were interviewing him.
That's what makes those ESPN 30 for 30 so great, is the archival footage, the old interviews. Yeah.
So, so that was a good experience, actually. And then we discovered that they wanted me to do more. I said, no, you guys acted like this was all a one-off and you're just printing money on it and there's no money for the rest of us. I said, that's not fair. There's no residuals. There's zero and they run 24/7. So,
yeah.
Time out. I want, you know, fool me once. Just tie us into some residuals. I'll do another one, but don't keep printing money off of me.
You're not getting a kickback from ESPN Plus or having these streaming, I guess. Yeah. That's funny. Well, I was going to ask you to prove that I read your book. I was going to say, if Jordan owned the bus, do you think there was a hat on the bus?
Not on that bus, for sure.
Not on that bus. Okay. Well, before I let you go, I cannot recommend the book enough, The Church of Baseball. It is a wonderful read as well. And there was two things I wanted to kind of reference from that book that kind of tie in. I had some stories of my own. The first, just real quick, I'll tell you, when I first moved to Los Angeles, I was working for a writer. He was a member of the Writers Guild. Nothing writing related. It was his girlfriend was working with the grocery workers union and they're about to go on strike. And so I was answering the phone for them. And the people who I was staying with, they didn't think I had looked hard enough. I was still crashing on their couch. I'd already gotten a job, but I didn't have a place. And so they asked me to leave. And so this writer friend said, I have an empty apartment in Hollywood. I'm living with my girlfriend. You can stay there until you can find a place to live on your own. And so I said, thanks so much. And he said, there is somebody else who's going to be there. He is a cinematographer. He lives in Santa Barbara. He just comes down to do prep work for movies. And while he's here, he stays with me. He pays me rent. So stay out of his way and just, you know, do your own thing. And I said, no problem. And so that first night that I arrived, this guy shows up and I said, oh, I'm sorry. I introduced myself and we got to talking and I offered to take him out for a drink. He's like, no, I got to get up in the morning. But I said, you know, what movies have you done that I would have seen? And he said, have you seen Pretty Woman? His name was Charles Minsky. And it was a real, real pleasure when I was reading the book to see his name pop up, because I did not realize he was associated with Bull Durham. What do you remember about Charles Minsky? Because I have met him several times. He actually got me on the set of one of his movies and I got to hang out for a day. He was a really, really nice man. I'm sorry that he didn't get the credit in Bull Durham.
Well, he got screwed in Bull Durham and I tried to give him his due, set the record straight, because he got sacrificed by producer, studio. I try to get to the bottom of it in the book. And it's a sign of how brutal it can get behind the scenes, where innocent people get thrown under the bus. He did a great job. It was a humiliating experience for him and for me that he had to be thrown away. I fought it tooth and nail. I was trying to not get fired myself.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Robbins, they were trying to fire. So it was pretty ugly. And Chuck, who's a really great cameraman, he was unfairly treated, put it that way, and that too is the business.
Oh yeah, just really nice man. I love when I see his name pop up when I'm watching a movie, because it does happen quite often. He's very prolific. And the other thing I was going to mention to you, my father was a fan of the Milwaukee Braves. I've heard stories about all my life. He has a Braves hat in his office. And there was a moment, we're from Southern Illinois. St. Louis is about an hour away. And there was a autograph convention, one of those old timers, all the Hall of Famers and stuff come in. And Warren Spahn was there. And I said, and that was his favorite player. And I said, Dad, we've got to go meet Warren Spahn. And he wouldn't do it. I can't go over there. I can't meet this guy. And I kind of smiled when I read your book and you were talking about Eddie Matthews. and how you did not go up to Eddie Matthews and talk to him. And so I wanted to, what was that relationship like with the Braves? And why couldn't you get the courage to go up to talk to Eddie Matthews?
I don't think it was courage. I think it was almost a moral decision for me. Why I also didn't go up to Mickey Mantle at the end of the book, who had talked about Bull Durham. It was leaving them alone in their space. In other words, what did I have to tell him?
Yeah.
That for me to talk to Eddie Matthews, I just wrote a book about it, really, about how he impacted our lives. He was just trying to get through the day.
Yeah.
He didn't need to hear from me. The fact that we went to Santa Barbara High and he was the biggest star ever there, and I have his bat because I won the batting trophy right over there. It's still sitting here.
Nice.
It's the only trophy I have, and the name's worn off it now. He didn't care. And I just wanted to leave him alone. And it was a choice, not a matter of fear.
Okay. Well, you never know. Since I've been in this town, I've been here 20 years now, and I'm kind of an extrovert. Obviously, I'm not going to bug people while they're eating dinner, but I do like the ability to, just, if you find your time, maybe like I said, there's a time and a place. And if you can reference something that maybe they don't hear very often, I do try to do that.
Well, I'm not bothered when people come up to me about a movie or something. I've noticed there's two kinds of people in the world, your kind and my kind. I never go up to anybody. It's in the DNA. I have no problem with your. I mean, Robert Wool goes up to everybody. He's the most outgoing guy in the world, and everybody loves Robert. And so it's just. I think I'm more, not an introvert, but I'm more of a loner, a little more shy. But give me a microphone in front of people, I can do my thing. Or give me a crew to order around, I'm happy. But then I kind of go, I'm the guy drinking over there talking to his buddy. That's it.
But it's a shame. Like I said, this has been so enlightening. I love your stories. I love the book. I've seen interviews. That Q&A in 2011 at Bull Durham, it was wonderful. And it kind of opened my eyes in that movie and made me like it even more. And I appreciate how much you took the time. I always feel weird at book signings where you're just like, okay, there's a line behind me, but I got a couple of interesting things to bring up with this gentleman, and I kind of want to share them. As we let you go, tell us, you said you've got a few things in the can or some possible sports movies. Is there one about hockey? I'm a big hockey fan. Have you ever tried to do a hockey movie?
No, I've turned down hockey because I don't know it well enough. I have a Western series that we are about to sign with AMC and hope that goes. It's already partly written. We have some big names attached. I'd like to do the Western. I have, obviously, sports scripts. I just wrote a new one about based on a book. Based on a magazine article has been out for 40 years that I optioned that nobody ever would have optioned, about Ted Williams at 66 when he's in the Florida Keys fishing and a famous writer goes down to meet him. And I don't know if it's very commercial, but it's a great script. I've got a Rose versus Giamatti project I'm working on, Pete Rose versus Bart Giamatti, based on a book. Really interesting. Mike Medavoy is a producer, just to show that 35 years later, we're still in business.
That's great.
And a couple non-sports things. So I've got a lot of activity out there.
Awesome. Well, I can look forward to what you've got next. Like I said, I appreciate you taking the time because you're one of those filmmakers I've always admired. Like I said, you have a certain formula that you've worked with in the sports movies that always make it entertaining. I will go watch Under Fire, I promise you. And I the Pursuit of D.B. Cooper looks interesting. I'm curious to see as I watch it if I can detect which scenes are the ones that you wrote.
Some of it was just trying to make sure it didn't follow. The story made sense. So, yeah, there's little bits. You could probably say I had something to do.
Yeah, and then when the time comes, when we do Play It to the Bone on our show, I've got some extra knowledge that I can bring up as well. So thank you for your time. I really appreciate it, sir.
My pleasure. Okay.
Out of Touchstone is a Honey Nerds production. For more information, go to outoftouchstone.com. Be sure to follow at Out of Touchstone on Instagram and Twitter. And also, please like, subscribe, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for listening.
So, you're cool, I'm cool, we're cool. Thank you. Good night.